But with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Ratahway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. إِنَّ رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية ادعوا ربكم تضرعا إنه لا يحب المعتدين. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Local U.S. officials say the suspect behind the recent deadly shooting in Buffalo intended to take as many black lives as it possibly could. Heavy fighting reported in the east of Ukraine as Russian forces try to encircle Ukrainian fighters in the Donbas region. The British Prime Minister says his government will set out plans to allow ministers to unilaterally scrap part of the Northern Ireland Protocol. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The people in the U.S. city of Buffalo hold a vigil to mourn 10 people shot and killed by an alleged white supremacist teenager. The gunman also wounded three in what authorities called an act of racially motivated violent extremism. Nearly a dozen of those hit by gunfire in a supermarket on Saturday were black. Police investigating the crime now. They say that 18-year-old Peyton Gendron now is in custody, was live streaming his carnage. The city's mayor says the killer's express purpose was to take as many black lives as possible. He has been charged with first-degree murder and another act of gun violence in California. A shooting at a church left one person dead and five others injured on Sunday. Officials say four of those injured are in critical condition. Well, a short while ago, we were joined by Frank Emspach, an emeritus professor from the University of Wisconsin, and he says that white supremacy is a core belief in the U.S. and has been part of the country's culture for two centuries.
Lately, of course, people recognize that there's a shift demographically. And everybody says that, you know, in 10 years or 20 years, white people will be a minority. Well, if for 200 years of the country's existence, more or less, white supremacy was part of the culture, part of the legal business here, it's very, very hard to all of a sudden say, well, that's all gone, in a deep way. Not necessarily people running around saying, well, I'm a white supremacist, but a really sort of core belief in part of the country. And that is what got expression and is expressed by the supremacy theory, by the replacement theory, and hence extraordinarily dangerous in a society like ours, where guns are very, very widely available, and people use them.
In other news, Russia trying to encircle Ukrainian forces in the Donbas region and fend off a counteroffensive around the city of Izium in the east amid the ongoing war between the two neighbors. Latest reports indicate Russia has pummeled new positions in eastern Ukraine. The main target has been Ukrainian command centers and arsenals in the Russian-controlled city of Izium. Moscow says it has struck those positions with missiles. Meantime, Ukraine says it repelled more than 15 Russian attacks on Sunday, destroying almost a dozen pieces of Russian equipment, including helicopters, cruise missiles, and drones. Izium is a strategic gateway to Donbas region, an area largely controlled by Russian-backed forces. More than 80 days have passed since the beginning of the Russian offensive in Ukraine. The Secretary General of the Western Military Alliance, NATO, says that Ukraine is capable of defeating Russia, adding that Europe and North America are united in supporting Kyiv.
But Ukraine stands. NATO is stronger than ever. Europe and North America are solidly united. Ukraine can win this war. Ukrainians are bravely defending their homeland. Discuss our strong support for Ukraine.
Speaking virtually at a NATO meeting in Berlin, Jens Stoltenberg urged the alliance to keep sending military aid to Ukraine. His call was echoed by German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock, and she stressed that NATO members are ready to provide military assistance to Ukraine for as long as needed to help it repel Russia's invasion. She said that NATO should help Ukraine defend itself, and this as the United States has already set aside some $40 billion in military and financial assistance to Kyiv. Our correspondent in Donetsk, John A. Miller, joined us a short while ago to discuss the latest developments in Ukraine, and he says that NATO needs much more effort to help Kyiv make advances in the current war with Russia.
The United States recently said they're going to give Ukraine around 40 or 50 billion U.S. dollars, but so much of that money will go to arms manufacturers in the United States. It will go on things like insurance and transport. And the fear is also that Russia, with air superiority inside Ukraine, is able to attack any of these missiles before they get to the front. It's easy to transport small arms, for example. You can transport them in civilian cars or in ambulances. But transporting large pieces like artillery, which is what the Ukrainians need, that's very difficult. And the Russians are able to attack those before they get to the front, because at the moment Ukrainians say they're winning, but when I say it's difficult to see how the Ukrainians can win this war, Russia essentially does have air superiority and huge artillery power, and Ukraine has none of that, and just getting these weapons to the front is going to be difficult. That's why at the moment, while the Ukrainians claim they're winning, they're also saying the next few weeks are going to be very, very tough. But at the moment, NATO is going to have to do a lot more if it does want Ukraine to win this war.
The post-Brexit trading arrangement remains a source of friction between the UK and the EU. The British Prime Minister says his government will set up plans to allow ministers to unilaterally scrap parts of the Northern Ireland Protocol. Boris Johnson says the protocol had an unintended consequences for his country. He said that there will be a necessity for London to act if the EU doesn't change its stance. Johnson underlined that his government is responsible to assure consumers, citizens, and businesses of Northern Ireland that they are protected in the long term. That has raised alarm in the bloc, which sees Britain's move a violation of the Brexit deal. EU member Ireland has urged the UK not to breach the accord by introducing new trade laws.
Unfortunately, it has been the briefings that has come from the British government this week that has raised a real red flag in Dublin and in Brussels. Because the British government is now threatening to break international law, to break a treaty that they signed with the EU and that they designed with the EU and ratified with a huge majority in the House of Commons. And in doing so, potentially creating huge problems on the island of Ireland. And while there are issues that need to be resolved...
The Northern Ireland Protocol was part of the UK's Brexit deal with the EU, and that effectively created a customs border in the sea between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK because of the province's open land border with EU member Ireland. Tensions surfaced over the issue after last week's elections in Northern Ireland. The largest unionist party there is now threatening not to take part in the government unless the protocol is abandoned. Well, moving up with the rest of this broadcast, Iran says it's serious in the negotiations for the revival of the 2015 agreement, but is also determined not to place its trust in the enemy for immunity from sanctions. Chief negotiator in the Vienna talks, Ali Bagharikani, says Iran is serious in the discussions and fulfillment of its international obligations. Bagheri, however, says all diplomatic potential should be used in line with national interests without reliance on foreigners. He says that the foreign ministry is using every means to remove the sanctions while also tapping into every international potential to improve Iran's ability to neutralize the bans. Tehran had said earlier that an agreement in the Vienna talks hinged on the United States' political decision for the removal of sanctions and guarantees that they would not be reimposed. Now, vote counting is underway in Lebanon, where people went to the polling station to choose a new parliament. Results are expected on Monday. The Interior Ministry put the turnout at just over 40%. Nearly 4 million people were eligible to vote. 128 seats are up for grabs. Over 700 candidates competed to enter parliament. The elections are held amid an unprecedented economic crisis that began in 2019. The crisis has led to a currency collapse and plunged over 70% of the population into poverty. The Hezbollah resistance movement blames the crisis on a U.S.-led conspiracy against Lebanon. The next parliament is due to vote on key reforms required by the International Monetary Fund to unlock financial support. Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian protesters in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Bira. Protesters were out on the streets to mark the anniversary of the Nakba Day, or the Day of Catastrophe. That's when Israel was created 74 years ago. Soldiers used tear gas and live ammunition to disperse the ralliers. Protesters waved Palestinian flags and denounced Israeli crimes. They held placards with signs stressing their right to return to their ancestral land. The protesters also carried pictures of journalist Shirin Abu Akla, who was fatally shot by Israeli forces on Wednesday. Similar rallies took place in other West Bank cities as well as the besieged Gaza Strip.
Palestinians took to the streets across the occupied West Bank to commemorate decades of ethnic cleansing of their homeland by Zionist militias, when an estimated 700,000 Palestinians were expelled from their homes and villages in 1948 to make way for new Jewish immigrants to create what's known today as Israel. For the Palestinians, Nakba means a painful and sad occasion. But it's also a reminder that the younger generation will exert all effort to stick to the right of return.
Look around you. After all these years, all the Palestinian refugees and thousands of people are taking part in this rally. This is insistence. We will never abandon our right to return. It's one of our inalienable rights.
Today we're here to tell the whole world that returning to our villages is all right. Once they said the elders will die, but now we will tell them the youngsters will never give up.
A 74-second siren was sounded across the West Bank at 12 noon local time, marking the 74 years that have passed since their Nakba, the catastrophe. Demonstrators from all walks of life and of all ages held maps of historical Palestine and large metal keys to symbolize their homes from which were forced to leave decades ago. The anniversary also comes as anger is boiling over the Israeli killing of prominent Al Jazeera veteran journalist Shirin Abu Akle.
Nakba anniversary has always been painful to all the Palestinians, and this year is more painful. Like every year, we commemorate our Nakba to tell the world that our homeland is unforgettable. That's why you can see people are still holding the keys to their ancestors' homes, as they still believe that they will return homes one day, and hopefully it'll be very soon.
Nearly 5 million Palestinian refugees remain scattered in different camps in the besieged Gaza Strip, the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria, including others dispersed around the world. All of them have a mutual dream, which is returning to historical Palestine.
Since 1948, Palestinians have remained steadfast in defending their right to return to their homeland despite Israel's continued ethnic cleansing policies. For Palestinians, Nakba remains a painful episode in history, and the agony continues to be felt amid Israel's escalated violence and crimes. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The people have rallied in the U.S. city of New York to mark the anniversary of Nakba, or Day of Catastrophe, and condemned the Israeli killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh.
Shirin Abu Akleh, we knew her for tens of years, and she was a very good reporter, and she was not biased. She was just reflecting what's happening in the occupied land, and she was mercilessly murdered.
I myself am Jewish, and I feel like it is a very strong and deep duty to criticize the Israeli government and stand up for the oppressed Palestinians that have been living there for hundreds of thousands of years.
Similar protests have also been held in other countries in solidarity with the Palestinians. Protesters in Australia, Denmark, the UK, and other parts of the world denounce Israeli brutalities against Palestinians. Now, African people, journalists, and the Taliban have condemned the death of veteran Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Akleh at the hands of the Israeli forces. They also urged the international community to break its silence and to stop the policy of double standard regarding the situation in Palestine. Our correspondent has a report from Kabul.
Afghans are outraged by the Israeli regime's Wednesday killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Akleh in the city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. Afghan reporters, who have been bearing the brunt of terror attacks and violation of their rights, best understand Palestinians, especially those who file reports in the occupied Palestinian territories.
As an Afghan journalist, I strongly condemn Israel's killing of our colleague Shirin Abu Akleh in Palestine. For sure, her death is a great loss to the media and reporters' society. Shirin Abu Akleh narrated Israel's long-lasting aggression against oppressed Palestinians, and she became the voice of the voiceless.
I was really saddened after I heard one of us, a committed Palestinian journalist, was shot dead by Israeli forces in occupied Palestinian territories. Reporters like Shirin are the true servants of the people, and they are always telling the truth. They must be protected. Hence, the international community should not remain silent on Israel's killing of journalists and attacking civilians.
Afghans also call on the United Nations, human rights bodies, and international courts to deliver justice for oppressed Palestinians.
Palestinians are coming under provoked attacks. It's not about Muslims or non-Muslims. The killing of reporter Shirin proved that Israel is against human rights and the freedom of speech. We're standing against the regime's moves. We might not be able to do anything significant, but we can raise our voice in support of people in Palestine.
I urge the international community to defend the rights of Palestine if it is impartial and for human rights. How can Israel dare to push continued violence on poor Palestinians? I condemn Israel's atrocities and the deadly role of its masters like the U.S. When will the world wake up and stand with oppressed and vulnerable people?
In the meantime, the acting foreign ministry led by the Taliban has condemned the regime's killing of Abu Akleh in the strongest terms, saying Israel seeks to conceal the persecution of the Palestinian people from the world. Afghans are paying tribute to Shirin Abu Akleh as the voice of the voiceless. People here are calling on the international community to hold Israeli forces accountable for their crimes against Palestinians. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And with that, we come to the end of this news broadcast from Tehran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
in the limelight.
The Zionist regime's international friends bear responsibility for each Palestinian fatality in the context of the occupation, even when they purport to oppose the deadly violence. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Maureen Claire Morphy, writer. This article is titled, Shirin Abu Aqila's Blood is on the Hands of Israeli Regime's Friends. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime's international friends bear responsibility for each Palestinian fatality in the context of the occupation, even when they purport to oppose the deadly violence. European, North American, and UN officials condemned the killing of Al Jazeera reporter Shirin Abu Aqila while she was covering an Israeli military raid in Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Those supposed condemnations variably included vague calls for an investigation and accountability without specifically naming the fabricated regime of Israel as the party, all but certainly responsible for Abu Aqila's death. Such calls for an investigation ring hollow when coming from parties that have failed to support the International Criminal Court's war crimes probe in Palestine. The UK, US, and Canada have actively tried to undermine that investigation, while the UN Secretary General's West Asia region envoys have refused to endorse it or any other international accountability measure against the fabricated regime of Israel. A preliminary investigation by Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group, based on an autopsy result and eyewitness testimony, concluded that Abu Aqila was killed by a bullet fired by Israeli regime troops. Troops had surrounded a home in the camp on the pretext of searching for wanted persons, according to Al-Haq, and were met with armed resistance. Abu Aqila was hit in the head by a bullet fired by the direction of Israeli troops, who had full view of the Al Jazeera crew and not the resistance fighters, whose fire would not have been able to reach the journalist. Another journalist, Ali Samoudi, was shot in the back during the same incident and was reportedly in stable condition. Moreover, the type of projectile found in Abu Aqila's brain is a bullet issued to Israeli regime troops. Al-Haq said that Abu Aqila's killing may amount to premeditated murder. Immediately after her killing and before any preliminary examination was possible, the Zionist regime launched a public relations campaign, distancing itself from responsibility for Abu Aqila's death. The Tel Aviv daily Haaretz baselessly claimed that even though the military has yet to conclude its investigation, Israel is pushing the message that there are indications that Abu Aqila was not killed by Israelis. The ambiguity introduced by the Zionist regime's public relations blitz was enough to stick, however. The effort was a success, with news outlets privileging the Israeli regime line over the testimony of Abu Aqila's colleagues who survived the attack and said that they came under Israeli regime fire. An unnamed Israeli official told Haaretz that the spin campaign had already influenced leading news organizations, including the Associated Press, Sky News, the BBC, and AFP. The official said that these agencies, which initially reported that Abu Aqila had been killed by Israeli fire, were now reporting that the circumstances of her death are under investigation, Haaretz added. Yet, there will be no credible Israeli regime investigation into Abu Aghila's death, as the Zionist regime's self-investigation mechanism only exists to shield the regime and its personnel from international accountability. It is possible that a low-ranking Israeli troop will be slapped on the wrist, as happened in a handful of other cases concerning the death of a Palestinian at the hands of the Zionist regime's military. But there will be no true reckoning for the authors of the Zionist regime's open fire policy, which is exercised liberally against Palestinians living under its military rule, guaranteeing that the bloodshed will continue. Calls for an investigation by parties in a position to put actual pressure on the Zionist regime are all the more insulting given that less than a week ago, the Zionist regime's highest court approved the forced expulsion of Palestinians living in the Masafer Yatta area of the southern West Bank. With the stroke of a pen, a trio of Israeli judges, one of them, a settler from the UK who lives in a West Bank colony, signed off on the violent displacement of more than 1,000 Palestinians from the land where they've lived for generations. In other words, they approved a war crime. These two, the European Union condemned as they condemned the killing of Abu Aghila. It is rare for the EU, which usually only expresses its concern, to condemn any violation of Palestinian rights, let alone twice in a week. But without imposing any actual consequences on the fabricated regime of Israel, such condemnation is an empty gesture. EU condemnation hasn't stopped the Zionist regime from carrying out the forced expulsion of Masafer Yatta, where it demolished Palestinian homes and other property, displacing Palestinian residents. Such condemnation is a mere performance intended to give the appearance of objection, but taking meaningful action. Shirin Abu Aghila was a U.S. citizen, as was Omar Asad, an older Palestinian man who was left to die on the ground after having a heart attack while being arbitrarily detained by Israeli troops who raided his West Bank village earlier this year. The fabricated regime of Israel initially lied about the circumstances of his death, claiming that he had resisted a check by the Israeli troops and was released alive. The U.S. pressed the Zionist regime for an investigation but didn't put any conditions on military aid, meaning that the Zionist regime had nothing to lose by failing to meaningfully investigate Assad's death. Any condemnation that doesn't come with consequences is actually a permission slip for the fabricated regime of Israel to continue to kill Palestinians, destroy their communities, and deny their freedom. It is a green light to the Zionist regime to keep murdering Palestinians with full impunity. Yet most deaths of Palestinians at the hands of the Zionist regime's military don't receive any condemnation from the regime's powerful friends, however hollow that condemnation may be. There were no condemnations from Brussels or Washington over the killing of 16-year-old Tahir Maslat in the West Bank, the 10th Palestinian child fatality at the hands of the fabricated regime of Israel so far this year. The Zionist regime claimed that the troops fired rubber-coated bullets at Palestinians who threw stones at troops who had raided Al-Bira, the town near Ramallah, the seat of the Palestinian Authority. That claim will be good enough for the diplomats and foreign press corps, who are all too happy to take the Zionist regime at its word, as worthless as it may be, and have allowed the fabricated regime of Israel, apartheid, and colonization to go on year after year, decade after decade.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly program that will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the detention of hundreds of Rohingya celebrating Eid al-Fitr in Bangladesh. And European leaders' failure to make Narendra Modi change his position on Russia in his Euro tour.
Bangladesh has given refuge to about 1 million Rohingya who face persecution for centuries. Their independent kingdom in Arakan, what is today known as Rakhine State, was raided by Burma in 1784 and they were crushed with Burma's independence in 1948. The 1962 coup made it worse and the 1982 Citizenship Act rendered them illegal. But the worst happened under the Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi only 5 years ago with hundreds of thousands of Rohingya fleeing to Bangladesh.
As Bangladesh's Muslims were enjoying the second day of Eid al-Fitr holidays, the police detained over 450 Rohingya on a beach in the town of Cox's Bazar. Like other Muslims, they too were celebrating the Eid. Police said the move was a part of security measures to provide safety for the tourists visiting that area. The beach of Cox's Bazar is the country's largest resort district, attracting millions of tourists during holiday seasons, such as Eid al-Fitr, which is a major Muslim festival in Bangladesh. The detained Rohingya were sent back to the camps to join about 1 million Rohingya refugees. They are banned from leaving the camps, surrounded by barbed wire. About 750,000 of them took refuge only 5 years ago, amid the crackdown by Myanmar's military and extremist Buddhists. Violence is on the rise in the extremely crowded camps. This has made Dhaka transfer over 20,000 refugees to the remote island of Basanjar in the Bay of Bengal. The Rohingya, who faced persecution in their home country, now have only two options: either to remain isolated in densely crowded camps in Cox's Bazar, or to move to the remote island prone to deadly cyclones during the monsoon season.
Bangladesh is giving protection to some 1 million Rohingya refugees in Cox's Bazar and Bahasanchar Island. At the same time, it has effectively restricted the freedom of movement of the refugees by banning them from leaving the camps. Transferring refugees to a flood-prone island, banning Rohingya-led community schools, denying employment rights for refugees, and bulldozing some 3,000 Rohingya shops inside the camps are other signs of Bangladesh's growing intolerance towards Rohingya. Let's see why this is the case.
The majority of the Rohingya refuse to return to their homeland. They'd prefer to stay in Bangladesh with no work, poor sanitation, and little education.
Unfortunately, not a single Rohingya could yet return due to the lack of political will and decisive action on the part of Myanmar in creating a conducive environment for return.
Providing some 1 million Rohingya with refuge has been challenging for Bangladesh. Exhausted Dhaka urges the world and international bodies to provide more assistance. It has called on the UN to increase its attention to the situation in Myanmar and pave the way for the safe and sustainable return of the Rohingya. Bangladesh's call comes as the UN has already described Myanmar's persecution of the Rohingya under the former de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. At the same time, the UN Refugee Agency reported Myanmar has killed men, slaughtered children, raped women, and burnt entire villages to the ground during the leadership of the Nobel Peace Prize winner. In the neighboring country India, the Rohingya are not welcome as much as they are in Bangladesh. India is not a signatory to the UN Refugee Convention of 1951, nor its 1967 protocol. Hence, the 40,000 Rohingya refugees in India face the risk of deportation, even those who hold UNHCR's refugee cards. Altogether, Bangladesh is the only safe haven for the Rohingya.
To have more insight on the plight of Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh, we are now joined by Mr. Phil Robertson, Deputy Asia Director at HRW Bangkok. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now let's begin with the conditions of Rohingya refugees in camps at Cox's Bazar. How are they being treated and how should they be treated? And also, the restrictions on their movement, why is it in place and can't it be removed?
Well, we are talking about the largest refugee camp in the world, and it is quite clear that there are major restrictions on the Rohingya that are abusing their rights. You mentioned the issue of restrictions on movement. What that means is the Bangladesh authorities will not allow people to leave the camp. They will not allow them to pursue livelihoods or, you know, earn money. And more than that, actually, they're building around the camps various different concrete and barbed wire fences, which are going to make it very difficult for people to move in and out of the camp, and also create significant dangers for people when there are issues of fires in the camp. There's been some major fires burning down large portions of the camp, and a number of people have been unable to flee these fires because of the fences, and, you know, the result has been injuries and deaths. Bangladesh also does not allow Rohingya children to pursue the right to education in the camps, and they've closed down many of the schools, which is frankly outrageous and unacceptable. So we think that the Bangladesh authorities can do a lot to improve the situation for the refugees there, you know, making sure that they have adequate food and medical services, ending the restrictions on movement, ending the restrictions on education, and allowing these people to lead more normal lives.
Now, Mr. Robertson, let's talk about the international law, which prohibits the forced return of refugees to places where their lives or freedom would be threatened. Considering the prosecution of Rohingya in Myanmar and that the UN says there is a serious risk that genocidal actions may occur or recur, Bangladesh cannot deport the Rohingya refugees. Now, how can this issue be addressed?
Well, there has to be a negotiated solution between the governments of Myanmar and Bangladesh, which would be supported by the UN Refugee Agency and by the international community. But that can only happen when there are guarantees of a safe, voluntary return for these refugees with full rights. I mean, and that means Myanmar granting them full citizenship rights, you know, and obviously amending the Citizenship Act of 1982, and permitting those who go back the right to freedom of movement, access to livelihoods, and access to basic services. You know, there has to be a situation where people are able to go back to a situation that really existed before 2012, when we had the first pogroms against the Rohingya. It is a major issue to be addressed, and so far we don't see the political will from the Myanmar government side to address this issue. It is a military government in Myanmar. The people who are in charge are the same people who drove the Rohingya out in 2017, and so unfortunately Bangladesh is stuck trying to get more pressure on Myanmar, but so far it's not been working, and they need more support to demand that Myanmar put in place the kind of guarantees and structures that will allow the Rohingya to return safely and voluntarily.
Said India is not a signatory to the UN Refugee Convention of 1951 or its 1967 protocol. It also does not have a clear refugee policy. There are reports that the Indian government deports many Rohingya refugees, even those holding UNHCR refugee cards. Now, how do you view this matter?
Well, it's outrageous and unacceptable for India to be arresting Rohingya refugees. And what they've been doing is arresting them and essentially throwing away the key. They've been keeping them in indefinite detention in horrible conditions in prisons and in immigration detention centers. Unfortunately, UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, is not doing enough to stand up to the Indian government and saying that this is unacceptable, that these arrests must stop, and that those refugees must be released from detention. I think what's happening is India is trying to put these Rohingya refugees in prison and make them so miserable that they will accept even to return to Myanmar, even though it's not safe for them to do so. And by going back, that they put their lives in danger. But, you know, for the Rohingya refugees, if they spent several years in a horrible prison cell and they're told the only way you can get out is to go back to Myanmar, they don't feel that they have a choice, and they're so desperate that they even will consider doing that.
Thank you, Mr. Robertson, for being on the program. Love to have you again. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media to the plight of Rohingya refugees.
Abdullah is a Rohingya photographer, sharing images of the Rohingya celebrating Eid al-Fitr in camp and saying it's been 5 years we are far from our home. Maung Zarni is a Rohingya activist who says this UN's funding means it is a false hope to wait for the UN to address the issue. Wei Wei Nu is a Rohingya rights advocate, reflecting a UN official visit to the camps and saying the world must approach the Rohingya situation.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi was in Berlin for the first leg of his three-nation European visit that also took him to Copenhagen and Paris. He exchanged views on strategic, regional and global developments with the European leaders. However, the visits came amid the Russian special operation in Ukraine. The host pressed Modi to take a stand against Putin and stop doing business with Russia, from which India now receives arms and oil. Let's take a look at Modi's European tour.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi began his European tour with Germany, indicating what Modi called the priority of Germany in India's foreign policy. In the meeting, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz praised India as Germany's central partner in Asia and said his country would like to expand close cooperation with India on global and military issues. Furthermore, it was announced Germany will make 10 billion euros available for bilateral cooperation with India in the coming years. On his second day of the European tour, Modi went to Copenhagen and held a bilateral meeting with Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen. In the presser after the meeting, Frederiksen underlined she hoped that India will influence Russia to end the war. Modi, without mentioning Russia, reiterated India's position and said they discussed Ukraine and called for a ceasefire and resolution of the conflict through dialogue and diplomacy. Modi also met with his counterparts from Finland, Iceland, Sweden and Norway in the second India-Nordic summit, in which they discussed blue economy, renewable energy, infrastructure investment and Ukraine. On his last day in Europe, Elysee Palace hosted Modi in his brief stopover to discuss cooperation in diverse security spheres, from defense technology to space issues, with the newly re-elected French President Emmanuel Macron.
On his first visit abroad this year, Prime Minister Modi had a jam-packed schedule with some 25 meetings in only 3 days. Various issues were touched upon, such as military cooperation, energy, climate change, trade, investments, and so forth. What made Modi's Euro tour significant was he was requested by almost all the leaders he met to condemn Russia for a special operation in Ukraine. However, the Indian Prime Minister reiterated his country's neutral position in all the meetings, summits, and statements.
What happens in Ukraine will have an impact on the Indo-Pacific region. It already has. Countries battered by 2 years of COVID pandemic must deal now with rising prices for grain, energy, and fertilizers as a direct result of Putin's war of choice.
The destinations of the Indian Prime Minister's first visit abroad this year included Berlin and Paris. The key roles of Germany and France in the European Union illustrate their importance for India. On the other hand, India, in addition to providing simple to skilled workers an expert workforce, is geopolitically important to the European Union. India is among a number of major economies which have continued to trade with Russia in spite of the Western sanctions on Russia. It is still a major importer of Russian arms and oil. India has maintained its neutral position on the Ukraine conflict against the anti-Russian policies adopted by the West. In their visits to India last month, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson sought to make Modi back down and sway New Delhi towards participation in their embargo on Russia. Similar to that, the leaders hosting Modi in his European tour pressed him to change his position. India has so far refused to condemn Russia's actions. Rather, the Indian Prime Minister used this visit to Europe to show that his government will not let the West undermine its key foreign policy, its ties with the Kremlin, that is.
Now, to have more insight on Modi's European tour, we are joined by Mr. Sanjay Kapoor, editor at Hard News magazine from Cyprus. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Kapoor. Now, although the West has bristled at India's neutral approach to Russia's special operation in Ukraine, Modi is warmly welcomed by the Western leaders. Why is India so important for Europe?
So India is important for Europe, undeniably so, because the country has grown, and in a certain way it has the entire foreign policy balance has changed towards the Asian region, You have the Indo-Pacific, where during the time of President Obama, the pivot shifted to the Asian region. And since then, I think the great amount of investment that has gone of the Western powers in Europe, and because they are trying to create a countervailing force to China, it is not just the India which is an issue, it is China that they want to balance, because China is growing at a speed which is something that they find threatening the European powers, although they trade regularly. But they think that the European values can come under great amount of pressure if it is not checked. And the other conclusion they have drawn is that in terms of numbers, in terms of population, a country which can serve as a counterpoint is India. So in the much before the happenings in Russia and Ukraine and much of what is happening, you would have noticed that there has been a certain push that has been given to India by US and the European powers, not so much Europe, but more so by the US. And it acquired a kind of importance which wasn't there earlier. And now when you have an incident like, or the development like what has happened between Ukraine and Russia, you suddenly realize that India has taken a position which is diametrically opposite to what the Western powers have been saying. And there is a reason. I mean, there's a forces of history which has been driving India to take that position, both in terms of our military cooperation, both in terms of our independent foreign policy that we practice for a larger part of our independent life. This was non-aligned view. The leaders of the non-aligned movement appreciated for taking a stand away from the Soviet bloc as well as the U.S. bloc, and even plowing a lone furrow. But this had been jettisoned quite a bit by the success, by powers like, I mean, the rulers that were there in India, even at the time when Manmohan Singh was the prime minister, and more so after Narendra Modi came in. And now that India takes an independent position, seems a bit incongruent with these times, because there's no middle ground.
Mr. Kapoor, Prime Minister Modi, despite the European leaders' insistence, only called for an immediate ceasefire and dialogue to address the issue in Ukraine. Now, do you think India will eventually change its approach to the Russian special operation in Ukraine at the Europeans' will?
I'm not very sure India would be persuaded by Europe. Europe is not the power which has the influence, which has what it takes, a great amount of influence or a clout on a country like India. If India is really going to listen, it is going to listen to the United States of America. And although an impression was created some time back that India could be persuaded, especially when we succumbed to the sanctions against us when we were buying oil from Iran or doing trade with Iran. So the belief was that if we could give up Iran, similarly we'll come under pressure when it comes to Ukraine and especially Russia. But there is a difference between Russia and Ukraine, Russia and Iran, for the simple reason that India has 65-70% of military platforms which are made in Russia. So if we are facing the heat or threat coming out from the two sides of the border, from Pakistan and China, so if we also jettison the support Russia is giving to India, then we become very vulnerable from the point of view of defense. So this is a message which was conveyed to US and its allies time and again that, you know, please do not ask us to give up Russia altogether, because Russia, because of reasons of history, because of many other reasons, is very important to us. Besides, during the tension with India and between India and China, Russia played a role in trying to talk to China to ensure that things don't escalate. India and Russia also members with a body where China is important, the Shanghai Cooperation. We are also members of the BRICS. So in different ways, we are engaged with each other. So we think that we are not in a position to give up Russia altogether, despite the pressure that Europe may be exercising on us.
What about the new deals, Mr. Kapoor? Prime Minister Modi managed to secure multi-billion euro deals in his European tour, in spite of India's relations with the US and EU-sanctioned Russia. Now, are the Western sanctions on Russia effective enough to stop third parties such as India from trading with Russia?
So there is some kind of a reduction in trade between Russia. But if you look at it, there has been a large component of the defense component in the trade between India and Russia. And the other part, which is very tiny, which made the maximum noise, was a purchase of oil from Russia. We barely used to buy less than 1% of our oil needs. But after Russia gave a significant concession to India, almost 30 to 40% of concession on whatever used to be the price at the time of the war, when war escalated from February 24th, then we have made significant purchase of oil from Russia. And there are a couple of refineries in India which deal with the Russian oil. There is one in Jamnagar. There's another one also in Gujarat, which is now owned by Rosneft, which is a Russian company. It is earlier owned by the SR Group. So these two refineries have been taking a colossal amount of Russian oil in the last 2-3 months. Some people say it's gone up by almost 700%. So there is no attempt to quantify it, but it only suggests that the trade between India and Russia hasn't really stopped, and we are still doing it. But the sanctions have begun to bite in other sectors. Like, India is a major center for polishing of diamonds in Gujarat, especially the city of Surat. So the 30% of all the diamonds in India is to come from Russia. So those diamonds have been stopped primarily because they used to be going to the Western market, these finished diamonds from India. And now the US and other Western allies have been demanding a clarification from India that these diamonds are not sourced from Russia. So from that standpoint, you know,